Good evening. Welcome to this wonderful candidates forum. My name is Jacqueline Frederick. I am the president of Latino Outreach Council, and I'm very proud that we have collaborated with the League of Women Voters to bring you this wonderful debate and informational meeting tonight. I want you to know that this is being videotaped. It will be played on a recurring loop on Channel 21, our public TV station. We want to thank AGP for videotaping this for us. And it also can be streamed off the internet as well. Slow-span.org. Okay? So that means that for people who have not been able to attend in person, you will have the opportunity to hear what the candidates have to say so you can make an informed decision. I want to thank our candidates, Debbie Arnold and Eric Michelson, for making this commitment to your community, because we know it's not easy to run for public office. It's not easy to be in the hot seat of public office, and thank you both very much for your commitment to your community and being willing to do this for all of us. Our format for this evening is going to include four wonderful volunteers who have volunteered to actually pose the questions. We've been here for a while this evening getting ready, and many of you have submitted some very interesting questions on little cards. We have distributed these to the speakers. We have some more questions we'll be distributing. And we want to invite you that if a question comes up that you think of, we have two people here. We have Vera and Janice who are here, and they are holding up cards. Just raise your hand. They're going to be on the lookout for you. And then you can submit another question if you'd like. We have 2 hours this evening, so we have quite a bit of time. Each candidate will be given 2 minutes to answer, up to 2 minutes to answer a question. We do have a wonderful timer from the League of Women Voters who will be giving them the heads up of what time they have. Latino Outreach Council, some of you may know, is an organization that we are a nonprofit organization dedicated to bridging the cultures and to being an informative and educational organization that helps Latinos in the community become more integrated in our community. That's our goal and aspiration. Of course, as you know, the League of Women Voters is, I think, one of the premier organizations with regard to promoting civic discourse in our community, and we're very proud that they have joined with us this year in hosting these forums. We would also like to thank Pastor Wes Thompson and the congregation of Dove Creek Church of the Nazarene for hosting us this evening in this absolutely beautiful facility. Thank you. I'm going to introduce our panel who will be reading the questions to the candidates. I'll start on the far side with Maria Elena Garcia. Maria Elena Garcia is president of the Hispanic Business Association. She's also a business owner, a Mary Kay consultant, and school board member. Thank you for your volunteering. Next, we have a face you'll recognize as well, Linda Hendy, president and CEO of the Atascadero Chamber of Commerce and president of Atascadero Economic Foundation. Next, we have a board member of Latino Outreach Council, Felix Esparza. He is 30 years in law enforcement. He is co-founder of YEL in Santa Maria, which is the Young Educated Latino Leaders. He's been involved in various service groups in San Luis Obispo and Santa Barbara counties, and he's a small business owner in Santa Maria as a communications consultant. Thank you, Felix, for volunteering this evening. And we also have Steve Orduño, president of LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, a 20-year county resident, 15 years in North County, and a Vietnam veteran, past president of the Cinco de Mayo Scholarship Committee. He awarded scholarships for 25 years. He works with youth seeking opportunities to further their education or leadership skills. He's a mentor to at-risk youth, a full-time pastor for 42 years, married to wife Cheryl for 45 years, 2 children, 8 grandchildren. Thanks, Steve, for volunteering. I want to make it clear that the questions posed by our wonderful panelists are not questions that they have created. These are questions that came directly from you, the citizens of this fine county this evening. I'd like to introduce Vera Wallen, who from the League of Women Voters, who has an announcement.
Okay, thank you. We're very pleased to be here and so happy to see so many of you here. It's wonderful. There are voter registration forms out there. You may have changed your address or done something like got married, or you know someone close nearby where you live that just turned 18. Have them register. They can do so until the 26th of May and still be able to vote. So it's important for people to do that. As you know, we would think that naturally. The other thing I want to tell you about is a special program that the League is putting on next Wednesday. It's called Safe in Slow. And I noticed already in some of the questions that there'll be some questions about this. It's something we're all asking ourselves about. But this is coming after the San Bernardino incident. And it's a presentation that we'll have with our sheriff, a slow police chief, and the county superintendent of schools, and they'll be talking about safety and how we can work together as a community to preserve that. So, thank you. Oh, I didn't tell you what time. It's 6:30 to 9, and it'll be at the Board of Supervisors Chambers in San Luis Obispo.
Thank you, Vera. I also want to point out that there is some literature. We've invited both candidates to feel free to put out literature so that you can take home with you more detailed information about the candidates. There's also information about the League of Women Voters and Latino Outreach Council. Okay, without further ado, I'm going to invite our candidates to give a brief 4-minute opening. And Eric, would you like to start?
Sure. Is the sound okay?
Perfect.
It's okay? More? Hello?
There you
go. That work? All right. Well, good evening, everyone. I'd like to thank the Latino Outreach Council and the League of Women Voters and our distinguished panel and all of you here tonight who, like me, care about and love San Luis Obispo County. Community involvement and leadership has always been important to me. I served as president of the Atascadero Chamber of Commerce, president of the Atascadero Board of Realtors. I served on the Atascadero Planning Commission and on the board of the Atascadero Youth Soccer Association and many other groups. I currently serve as president of San Luis Obispo Natural Foods and on the board of the local chapter of California Certified Organic Farmers. And currently, I'm the vice chairman of the San Luis Obispo County Agriculture Liaison Advisory Board. I recently retired from People's Self-Help Housing after 17 years, where I was the asset manager responsible for over $200 million worth of affordable housing, farm worker housing, senior housing, from Paso Robles to Ventura. I created annual budgets and was responsible for the long-term capital planning for those properties. Today, our main issues revolve around the high cost of living and the protection of our quality of life. According to the San Luis Obispo economic forecast recently, we must solve 3 very important issues: housing, water, and jobs. Because of the high cost of housing, it's difficult to attract qualified employees, even doctors and other professionals, not to mention our young people that find it very difficult just to find a place to live. I support plans to reduce development costs and implement the county workforce housing ordinance as soon as possible and encourage infill development, not more sprawl. I support responsible management of our groundwater basins and hopefully on a local basis. My opponent does suggest that large water users could just form an irrigation district. I don't think that's feasible, and it doesn't address groundwater overdraft or SGMA compliance. We really need to support local job creation. Our construction trades, the electricians, the plumbers, all provide excellent training programs that lead to head of household jobs. And we need to support our local businesses and make sure they have a solid preference for doing business with the county. Finally, a top priority of mine is to end the divisiveness and bring civility and cooperation back to the Board of Supervisors. I have a wide range of support from hundreds of local citizens throughout the county, employee groups, small business owners, environmental groups, elected leaders, and I have both Democrats and Republicans working on my campaign. You know, after all, the Board of Supervisors is a nonpartisan position. And I think that's one of the differences between me and my opponent. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Thank you. Ms. Arnold.
Thank you. And I, too, want to thank you all for taking time out of your evening to join us today. This is a fantastic turnout, and it's really important. I mean, to have the folks that are elected in this next election to represent you at the county level will be a voice speaking on your behalf. So thank you all for being here. Most of you, I think, I've met before, and you know my background, but I'll quickly talk a little bit about myself before we get into the policy issues. I've been married into the Arnold family for 40, almost 1 years now, coming up on that anniversary, but a family that's been in the farming and agricultural business in the Pozo Valley for 100 years now. And so my experience includes that agricultural industry, small family farming background. But like so many other farm wives, I had a business here in Atascadero while we were raising our two kids. I owned a preschool on Morrow Road and came to work every day for 17 years, dropped the kids off. They went to school and their extracurricular activities, and then back to the ranch we'd go at the end of the day. So the experience, those 17 years, I worked with thousands of families, and I think got a really good feel for the people that live here in our community. My husband Steve and I, some of you know Steve, we also spent a lot of time when the kids were growing up coaching youth sports and really being part of the community here in Atascadero. When our two children went off to go to Cal Poly, moved to San Luis and went to go to Cal Poly, that was when my husband was saying, you know what, something's got to go here. We have too much work to do for the two of us. And I went back home thinking I was going to be more help at the ranch. And that's when I had the opportunity to really get behind the curtain in politics, so to speak. I was offered a position as a legislative assistant for the then 5th District Supervisor, Mike Ryan, and I spent nearly 5 years doing that, getting experience with county government. Then I had a fantastic opportunity to go to work for Sam Blakesley when he was elected to the Assembly. I worked for the State Assembly and then later the State Senate under Sam. It's been invaluable experience for me to have had that opportunity to work in government at the state level, as I've been representing you for over 3 years now. I chose to run for this position because to my family and to many of the people that I'm close to, the land use issues make a big difference. And I felt like at the time, my experience, just my family experience, a mother, a grandmother and a wife and a working mom all those years, and the experiences that I've had might bring a voice to the Board of Supervisors that hadn't been there. So it's been a fantastic opportunity, and it's been an honor to serve all of you. I know that and I don't think anyone would disagree with me that we live in a very diverse county, and you know, it was mentioned a need for more civility on the board. 80%+ of the time we vote unanimously on things, but some of us get passionate about particular issues, I think, when we're representing the diversity of our particular districts. But all in all, that's very healthy, and I understand that we need good representation from each district all coming together to make policy that fits the county. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much again. And we're going to start our first question with Maria Elena. And the first question will be posed to you, Eric. Mm-hmm. And then it will go to Debbie, who will answer this same question. And after that, we'll rotate off so you each have opportunities to be the first person to answer a question. So we'll start with Maria Elena.
All right. Thank you. All right, Mr. Eric. What do you think about economic equality in Slo County, and how can we reduce it?
Did you say economic inequality?
Inequality.
Well, first of all, we have to provide enough jobs for people so they can work. There shouldn't be any discrimination whatsoever with regards to race, ethnic background, sexual orientation, whether you're a man or a woman. We should have the same wages based on your experience and your abilities. So I there's no place for it. But, you know, we can do more. You know, we have to do outreach, you know, using our community groups, our excellent opportunities to outreach to people that maybe don't necessarily apply for a job. I know we did that in affordable housing. We had to write a marketing plan to determine how we might be able to apply to those persons least likely to apply. And so our marketing plans were based on that. And I think you can use the same concept in, as far as employment. Thank you.
Debbie.
Thank you. One of the planks in my platform when I ran originally, and it continues to be a plank in my platform, is promoting a healthy economy that then in turn produces good jobs. I mentioned the diversity in our county, and it is true. We have quite a student population in and around San Luis Obispo, and we have quite a senior population of retired people throughout the county. So I believe we'll always have a bit of a diversity as far as income equality. But that being said, when I first ran for office here in the county, I realized that, regulation and excessive fees was really hurting small businesses, hurting the economy, and in turn, hurting job opportunities. And since I've been elected, I've been very mindful at every vote that to be able to promote that healthy economy, we do need to allow small businesses to thrive and prosper and slow down on the regulations that just haven't, with no accountability, same with the taxes and fees. It makes a difference in a community like ours, and I'll continue to be mindful of that.
Thank you. Linda, your question posed to Debbie, please.
Okay. Why did you agree or disagree with the proposed water district, and why?
Okay, very good. I just mentioned that I have an agricultural background, and it's been a very interesting 3 years. The water district that was proposed and supporting that water district, a lot of out-of-the-area investment, big agriculture. I'm a free market capitalist. I think it's great when investment prospers and thrives. But what we were seeing originally when the water district was proposed, it was using a very legal but very inequitable process for a regular irrigation district. When it was first applied for, 30 landowners own more than half of the acreage in the area proposed, and that created a situation where when landowners were asked, do you want to be part of this water district, 30 yeses could be as many as 5,000 no's. And this is people's property. So that was originally that was my first problem with the way it was set up. But secondly, you know, people voted, and I think that what the landowners in that area were saying, we don't want to create another layer of government, one that's been given extraordinary powers and authority to tax and regulate us on our property. I think that they have confidence that in the unincorporated areas, our county public works and its water division who have done a lot of work in the Paso Basin will do a fine job in SGMA compliance. Thank you.
Okay, Eric.
The Water District. First of all, I'd like to applaud the efforts that the Paso Robles Groundwater Advisory Committee worked for years to put together that original plan. That was a board, that was a group, a committee appointed by the Board of Supervisors to come up with a plan, and they did. It wasn't approved by the voters, so now we're to step two. We still have to comply with SGMA, so we're going to have to do something. We're going to have to put together a groundwater management agency, and that's going to have to, that's going to cost some money. So I do agree to somewhat with some of the supervisors' comments in general that the Public Works could help to get the ball started. Perhaps the county can loan money to that to get that started. And like at the Avila project, where now we have a pipeline coming from, possibly coming from Diablo Canyon to service the five cities areas with desal water, the county is expecting those water areas to to water districts in the five cities to pay that money back. So I think the county can do some seed money to get the project started, but eventually the people in the Paso Robles Water District are going to have to step up to the plate. They're going to have to think about how they're going to pay for it in the long run. Because you can't expect the people, say, in Los Osos to pay for it. The people in Los Osos just got through finishing a sewer plant, and they're paying $175 a month for their sewer. And also, they're putting groundwater back into the basin with that project. They're doing their part. So the people in Paso Robles are going to have to step up to the plate, too. It is eventually going to cost them some money. Thank you.
Thank you. Felix, your question to Eric.
Okay, Eric. What can the county do to address housing for low and middle income citizens?
Low and middle income?
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
Well, that's a good question. There's two different types of affordable housing that you're looking at. There's low and very low income housing, and I think we're doing a pretty good job of that with groups like People Self-Help Housing and the Housing Authority. We're always building homes for people that earn under 80% of area median income. And median income is around $60,000 or so for a family of four. So that means that somebody, a family earning $48,000, I think there's a number of apartments for them. We have huge long waiting lists, though, so we're going to need more of that. But a bigger problem is moderate housing or workforce housing that can go up to 140 to 160% of area median income. And the county is putting together right now, the planning department, a workforce housing ordinance that spells out how we can build more housing for those moderate income peoples. And you're talking about smaller homes, 800 to 1,200 square feet, on much smaller lots. And I think that's the way to go. And more dense, more homes per acre. But those things are going to be, in the urban areas and in appropriate county areas. But the county right now is developing that workforce housing ordinance. I think it's a good step forward. We're looking forward to the future with that plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Debbie.
The affordable workforce housing, very important in this county. This is a place that a lot of people want to come and live, and sure, supply and demand create a situation where housing is expensive. But that is one area the supervisors can really make a difference by zoning properly and zoning enough property that we know that our inventory of workforce housing is adequate. Another thing is we just continue to add fees for this and fees for that. Taxes go up, and that all adds up. Making material available that is more local saves money on both road maintenance and affordable housing. So all those things, and it's a combination. It's taken us a while to get here, and I think it's just, again, being mindful. Every time we add costs to building, it's going to make the cost of housing go up.
Thank you. Steve, your question will be posed to Debbie first.
Good evening. First of all, thank you both for being here tonight. As you're well aware, there's been a lot of criticism in the press, et cetera, about our educational system lagging behind other nations, et cetera. We can't fix all that, but we can concentrate on what's here in the county. So the question is real, very simple. Would you please discuss school education funding and how that is accomplished in this county?
Yes. Property taxes is a key tax mechanism for our schools. And again, it goes, I mean, the kind of the nexus, if I could connect the dots, is land use policies and the kinds of properties and the viability of our economy all directly connect to that property tax revenue that goes into our schools. I taught very young children for so many years, and I completely understand the importance of quality education and the need for it. And our family does what we can to support the schools in every way. But I think as a policymaker in this county, again, it's being mindful of the policies that we create that allow the, you know, property tax income to flow. Will it'll be a direct benefit to funding a quality education for the young people here in this county.
Thank you. Eric.
For property taxes, I believe, have a just a small amount of the educational cost or income that goes to the schools. We also have to look at ADA from the state. The average daily attendance is a big component of education financing. It's been about 40 years since I was teaching. I taught in the Templeton School District for 5 years and taught special education. It was a great opportunity for me to learn a lot about education. I served on the Templeton Teachers Association and helped to bring wages up to a livable wage for teachers in Templeton. When I started, you could barely get by. Education is tough. Back in the 70s, Proposition 13 came up, and that was, I thought, very important, and I support it. Prop 13, my superintendent told me at the time at Templeton that you can't support Prop 13 because schools are going to go out of business. And I said, well, I'm going to go out of business if I keep getting taxed. I'm a homeowner, too. But I think there's a lot of ways to fund education, through property taxes, through the state, the federal government. Funding is just part of it. I think in California, we spend quite a bit of money per student, but we're not getting the same results that other states do. So we have to look at the quality of education that we're getting. I think our teachers are doing a pretty good job, but they also have to work with the families and kids that are coming to school not properly prepared, not having a good a meal before school. That's difficult for the teachers to work with. So education is more than just money. Thank you.
Thank you. Maria Elena, your question will be posed to Eric first. Mr. Eric, how do you believe you can revitalize community groups bring them back to life?
Revitalize
community groups.
Oh, community groups?
Yes.
Community groups and bring them back to life. Well, that's interesting. I've worked with community groups before, and bringing them back to life sometimes is finding something common amongst the members. I remember when I was president, I was on the board of directors for the Tascadero Board of Realtors. And the board was having a rough time deciding whether or not to get involved in politics. And they, in the Tascadero here, and they agreed to support a certain individual for city council. And the other people, about half the people on the in the Board of Realtors decided to quit. We shouldn't be involved in politics. And the other said we should. It divided the board, and the president of the board at the time quit because he had a vote of no confidence. He wasn't getting any confidence from the rest of the members. So I decided to stay on. I was the treasurer. I needed to stay on to the board to keep that thing organized. So I looked to the members. I looked for people that I could bring together into that board and put it back together. But we needed to find something common to work on. And one thing we did, a lady named Sharon Morin is a realtor in town. She came up with a great idea. Why don't we do a realtor's golf tournament? And that'll do two things. It'll get the whole board back together, working on a common cause, you know, the golf tournament. And it will do the community good. We'll donate that money to the zoo. And we donated $10,000 to the zoo on that first golf tournament. It was one of the very first celebrity Well, golf tournaments in the county like that. Later in the years afterwards, we gave $10,000 to the women's shelter. But it was a way to bring the community or the realtors back together while also improving the image of the realtor in the community. So it was a great opportunity. I think, you know, that's what you have to do is find common purposes.
Thank you. Debbie.
The community groups, another thing we can all agree on here tonight is that we do have a very active, all the communities in San Luis Obispo County, very active. And, you know, from senior organizations to children's organizations to service groups to nonprofits, there are so many choices. And I think if anything in this county, you just have such an assortment, you could stay busy every day with groups. And I've seen some of our community groups grow in membership and kind of ebb and flow over the years. But I think probably my answer to that would be it's a personal choice, and I feel that we're all fortunate that there's just about something for everybody. So finding 1, 2, 3 or 5, if you're really energetic, organizations to be a part of, and doing good work in the community or having a presence in the community is a wonderful thing. And I know so many people do take advantage of the opportunities we have here. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda, your question will be posed to Debbie.
Okay. Are you a member of the Tea Party? If so, why or why not?
Gosh, a member. I don't think my name is on any membership list, but I'll tell you what, there is an active Tea Party here in the North County, and I believe once a month, or anyway, it seems to me once a month, there's noticing through the radio stations, et cetera, where the Tea Party, North County Tea Party, brings speakers into the area to educate folks, to encourage discussion and debate. And I certainly have attended. Our sheriff speaks there often. I've spoken there before. Our district attorney, a lot of our community leaders have spoken. And for me, I appreciate the opportunity to hear others speak on different topics, and appreciate these groups that care enough about their community to take a hold of the issues and try to bring speakers in to help others get more facts.
Thank you. Eric.
No, I don't belong to the Tea Party. That's a simple question. But I think it's another interest group in the community that we need to listen to. I don't have to agree with their philosophies or their ideas, but it's a, you know, my philosophy on making decisions is to listen to everybody. Everybody has a point of view, and everybody's valuable, and I'll listen to everybody. I don't have to always agree, but I will listen. Thank you.
Thank you. Felix, your question will be posed to Eric.
Okay, thank you. Eric, some people feel that Slo County has a gang problem. If so, what can be done about it?
Well, yes, there is a gang problem. There's a gang problem. There's a problem with drugs, especially heroin these days. A lot of young people are resorting to heroin, even in Atascadero and Paso Robles. And the gangs are possibly bringing that stuff in. I know there is a gang task force that the sheriff has established. I went on the other day looking, trying to get more information about it because I haven't been that involved with it, but I wanted to find out more about it. And they do have an office in San Luis where they meet. They have office hours. But I don't know exactly what they're doing, but I think it's very important to get involved and find out the gang members. And I think the sheriff is doing a pretty good job. They have a program right now where they'll identify the gangs and do, you know, research on them to find out what they're doing. And then they'll arrest and get them off the street. So there is a program out there that's sort of working right now. I'm not that familiar with it, but the sheriff is doing a pretty good job of getting a handle on it. Paso Robles also has a gang task force up there. And we need to give them all the support we can to get this under control. It's a terrible problem. You know, we've seen what's happening in Santa Maria. We've had too many murders down there. And it's not just a problem in Santa Maria. It's also up here, too. So I will give this as much support as the sheriff needs and as much as we can to the individual police departments in our communities to control the gang situation.
Thank you. Debbie.
Sure. According to our law enforcement officials here in the county, we do have a gang involvement moving into the county, both from the north and from the south. So I know it's something that all of law enforcement here in the county, including the sheriff's gang task force, is really working on. But again, here comes the preschool teacher in me. I think what we can do as community members is to try to redirect our young people and just kind of keep them from going down that trail. Provide them with other activities, plentiful activities for young people to get involved in that are wholesome and good for them, that will keep them from even being attracted to the gang lifestyle and the gang involvement. Beyond that, we really do have to support our law enforcement when they ask for the help. They are doing their best and doing a good job, and I know that they know they have the support presently from the Board of Supervisors to help them work these things out. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve, your question to Debbie.
As we're well aware, the economy has pushed a lot of people to the limit, and so as a result, we have problems with homelessness. And there's probably nothing that tugs at the heart of a mom or a dad than homelessness among youth. So the question is very simple. Is there a local law or ordinance that you're aware of that says minors can't stay at homeless shelters, for instance, Echo or Down and Slow? Yeah, is it funding? And then the question simply says, what is the difference between someone who is 17 and a half and someone who's 18 living on the street is not safer than the shelter? So the cutoff point, and how do we deal with that?
Yeah, and excuse me, that is true. There has been discussion. It is difficult for homeless shelters. Well, it's difficult and possibly illegal at times to have underage youth under the roof of someone that isn't a parent or a guardian. So here we go again. I mean, sometimes our well-meaning laws don't always match the reality. Of course, we're trying to do all we can to diminish homelessness here in our county. For the last 3.5 years now, I've been chairman of the Homeless Services Oversight Council. And I want to say we have had a lot of success. We've begun some new programs, and those programs have proven to be successful. Our Housing First, our 50 Now, you hear those different terms, but that is targeting the most chronically ill population of our homeless, who 10% of the top 10% of those folks are using 90% of the resources. So by getting those folks housed, we'll be able to have more resources freed up to take care of some of the other demographic of the homeless population. I am looking forward also, beyond the successes we've had, and I'll get in a quick plug, the homeless population of the last census in our county was down 31%, and veterans homeless numbers down 45%. And I know we have some people that could speak to this better than I here in the audience, but it is my hope. And it's through the community members, and we should be seeing soon, in the next couple of years, a wonderful homeless service center that will help provide services to all of age groups here in the county.
Thank you. Eric.
Well, I certainly think that we should be able to provide housing or short-term housing for people that are under 18. I've worked with Child Protective Services in my position as the broker for People Self-Help Housing. When we had evictions or parents being arrested, then the children would be alone. So Child Protective Services was always called to help out. A homeless shelter has someone that's younger than 18, I would hope that they would call Child Protective Services and get them a place to stay for them. But hopefully the new shelter will provide opportunities for housing some of these underage kids. I know at Peoples we did have programs. We still have programs called Rapid Rehousing, where we try to find veterans housing as soon as possible. We're working with the Housing Authority to get vouchers for homeless people. The First 50 program that Supervisor mentioned is an excellent program. We've already housed those 50 most vulnerable, and we should continue that. I'm looking forward to the new shelter there on Prado Road, too, and I hope that gets done soon, and that we make sure that we have provisions for the under 18 people, kids.
Great, thank you. Mary Elena, your question to Eric. Yes, Eric. Are you or are you not concerned about Harvard University and their substantial investment in this area?
Am I concerned about Harvard investment? I vaguely heard about Harvard. There were some concerns that they were going to export water through the aqueduct or something. It was one of the, it was a fair tactic that opponents of the Paso Robles Groundwater Basin District were throwing out there. Some people said that Harvard was going to buy up all the water and put it in the aqueduct. The only problem was the aqueduct just flows west. It doesn't flow east. It can't flow east. It pumps towards the west. So what are they going to do, truck the water? So I'm not concerned about Harvard. If they want to make investments in our county and improve our county, that's great. More power to them.
All right, Debbie.
Throughout the discussions of the water district, and we know that it's a fund affiliated with Harvard University, but it's under several different names. It's investment money coming into our county, and Harvard's not the only the Harvard folks are not the only investments being made in this county. There are several large holdings now that are owned, properties that are owned by out-of-state companies. You know, properties, this is a free market system, and properties purchased by freely by anyone, and the fact that investments are being made in this county, it's nothing really, it's nothing new. So I think that the concern came about that the other people that own property in the area just wanted to be sure that they would be free to use their property in the way they wanted and be able to afford to stay on their property. And again, this is nothing new, and it's really when property goes up for sale, people buy it. So again, a welcome neighbor, as long as I think that I've said all along through all of the disagreements about how to handle the water situation. My job right now as a county supervisor is to do what I think is in the best interest of the people that live here, and also the best interest of the long-term interest of the county to be able to control their resources and provide for their citizens. Thank you.
Thank you. Linda, your question will be posed to Debbie.
Okay, Debbie, what are your biggest concerns over the next 4 years for SLO County?
Okay, well, we do have some choices to make and some decisions to make, and water has been at the top of everyone's mind. We need to ensure that we have an adequate water supply for the folks that live here. And after that, we need to make decisions. What are our goals? Do we conserve to the point that we're sustainable and stay put? Or if we want to allow for more growth, then we might be looking, along with so many others in this state, for a surplus water supply to come in. But that's going to be a concern about how we handle, now that we are hopefully we're coming out of a very severe drought cycle, that we do not have to experience a shortage of something as critical as water. We have some other things on the horizon, though. It was mentioned before that we have some gang activity moving into the county, and with AB 109, the state bill that has put more responsibility on our county jails. I mean, law enforcement is really going to need our support, and it's going to be interesting to see or ensure that we keep our citizens safe here in the county. New things we've got, we'll be addressing marijuana cultivation and sales in the county and where the appropriate places for that are going to be. So there will be some policy decisions to be made that will shape the future of our county, no doubt. Thank you.
Eric.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Almost threw me off here. What are your biggest concerns over the next 4 years for SLO County?
The next 4 years. Okay,
next four
I didn't.
Years.
That's what I wanted to hear. Yeah, the 4 years we have to get we have to get in compliance with SGMA too on the water. We have 4 years to really do that in all our basins. We have five basins that are in overdraft as far as water goes. So if we want to control our water ourselves here in the county, have local control over our water, we need to address all the basins as far as water goes. We also need to address affordable housing. That's a big issue. Affordable housing is huge. We're getting some nice new businesses in the county. We've got Mind Body was a new business that came into San Luis Obispo, along with Rosetta and other businesses in town. But we're finding that their employees are having to drive all the way to Lompoc for housing. So it's also impacting our roads. Every day, if you listen to the radio, it talks about the impacted Shell Beach Straits. Even our highways up here in the North County are impacted because of a lack of housing where the jobs are. Atascadero has a good supply of housing, but we don't have the jobs. That's why some of our businesses just aren't successful, because there aren't enough people that actually work here. So we need Atascadero to help Atascadero get more jobs up here, so then people don't have to drive down the grade and impact the highway. So the traffic's a big problem, housing's a problem, water supply. Those are the big ones that I see right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Felix, for Eric.
Okay. As a county supervisor, what will you do to streamline the planning department and reduce cost of building homes?
Streamline costs, okay. Well, I'll have to tell you, I've been in the real estate development business since 19, I built my first house in 1975. In those days, you could turn in a set of plans that was a couple of pages. Now you have to turn in a set of plans that it's probably a good 12 inches in diameter to set up. It's very difficult to work with the planning department in some ways. I mean, they're very helpful, but they have rules they have to follow. So we need to look at the rules and see what's really necessary. We've gone overboard somewhat on some of our regulations as far as seismic compliance, fire safety. I know that one of the things that I had to deal with was fire sprinklers, and they add a tremendous amount of cost to a property. They're very helpful, though, in apartments, but then sometimes in single-family houses, I think the people should have a choice of whether or not they want to do that. But right now, they are required. There's other things that are required that maybe don't need to be. So we streamline the process. Well, hopefully, when a new project comes forward, they're going through CEQA. CEQA, and that's the Environmental Quality Act, So it takes a lot of time to do that. I was involved in a CEQA problem when I was doing a development here in town. It cost me almost 2 years of delay in that project. And by the time that 2 years was over, the economy had turned around completely. And this was in the 1990s, when, if you remember, the economy tanked. Because of, those extra requirements, it cost me a lot of time. Actually, it was another developer, because we were doing two projects together, that I had to even talk about CEQA. Later, when he decided not to do his project, the city said I didn't have to do an environmental impact report. I had a negative declaration. There's a lot of delays in the process, and we just need to streamline it.
Debbie.
In speaking to the home builders, especially throughout the county, one of their biggest problems is the certainty and the specificity in our planning department. policymakers, we need to be more definitive. I saw this working at the state level as well, that oftentimes legislation or county ordinances are passed with a lot of wiggle room or a lot of language left up for interpretation, and it makes it really difficult. If we're zoning for the inventory we need, and we're very clear about it, and the rules and regulations that go along with the particular projects are very clear, then it should provide certainty to the builders. They know what they need to do, they know what it's going to cost, and they just get busy doing it. And it should be then the planning department's role should just simply be enforcement of those rules and regulations that are laid out clearly, and making sure that the projects are built correctly.
Thank you. Steve, for Debbie.
I have a couple of questions here. I'm going to just combine them just a little bit because they deal on the same subject. I am assured that both of you are wanting to uphold the laws, but the questions are real simple. There is a lot of labor that is done out there that is being done by undocumented workers. The question is really simply, who's going to do it if they don't, and what is your position on hiring undocumented laborers, agricultural laborers in particular?
Yes, that's been an unsolved dilemma for a long time, hasn't it, Steve? Yes. You're right. The agricultural community has depended on undocumented labor, but I think I know what the rules are when a landowner is hiring labor. If that person presents the proper documents, then they've presented the proper document. It's not really up to the landowner to be expected to differentiate between fraudulent documents and correct documents. But it's been one of those things that that the well-meaning laws don't quite cover the reality of the situation. Without our farm worker labor force, we see a lot of it in the hospitality industry, undocumented labor, a lot in the construction industry. They're doing jobs, and they're doing jobs that we need to have done, affecting our housing, our food supply, and our tourism economy. So one of those things that I think just gently and slowly we really do need to follow the law, and we need to try to make corrections all the while realizing that these are folks that are coming here to take jobs that, we certainly do welcome the hard work that they bring to the county. Thank you. Eric.
Well, it's a pretty appropriate question right now because in the Napomo area, we had a gentleman that was working with the Visitor Farm Worker Program. It was going to have 160 laborers working, living in seven homes down there, and someone was not very happy with that and set those homes on fire. That was terrible. But that program is an excellent way to get additional workers in legally. And they're short-term, and they do the job, and they leave. But you have to provide housing, you have to provide transportation and food. And when working with People's Self-Help Housing, I met with Dana Lilly, who was in charge of the county affordable housing and housing element programs at the county. We talked quite a bit about the need for on-farm farm worker housing. We need to be able to put farm labor housing on the farms. We don't have a really good ordinance on that right now. We need to make that available, because that's a problem in the Pomo. They had to buy homes in the neighborhood to put their workers in. I think we should make it possible for a farmer to build housing on the farm to house their workers. That way they can qualify for this program and get additional workers. The high cost of living is also even difficult for local workers. Even if they got a job on the farm, they're not making enough money to afford rents. So it'd be good for them, too, to have housing on the farm. And I think that's one good way that we can help out with the labor situation.
Thank you. Maria Elena, question for Eric.
Mr. Eric, wealthy landowners are back on top after the recession, but regular families still struggle. What should we do?
Okay. That's another interesting question. But I guess that the question really is that we have some people that have not enjoyed the fruits of our expansion of our economy. Some people are doing quite well and some people aren't. So that means we just don't have enough jobs for those people. So we have to work on that part of it. We have to try to attract more businesses around here and get more jobs available for people that aren't able to work. Then for those people, we have to have a safety net, too. If they're really trying to work but can't find it, that's tough. But I think there's plenty of jobs out there. I've seen a lot of advertisements for jobs. Some people just got to get out there and do it. I remember a few years ago when I was going to college, my parents called me up. They weren't very happy with my grades. They said, Eric, we're not going to support you in college anymore. Go get a job. That's what I did. I went out and got a job. I washed dishes at Sierra Vista Hospital. And it was great. I was able to pay my rent. And those jobs are out there. Sometimes you have to suck it up a bit and just get it done.
Debbie. We're seeing that all over the country, in the state, and particularly in an area like this where housing costs are extreme. I could tell you, when I opened my business back in 1982, my small preschool business, I was an entrepreneur that had a dream about what I wanted to do, and I was really able to do it. And I know that today, and again, I'm going to go back to blaming excessive regulation and fees. It's very, very difficult. I mean, small business is the backbone of the American economy, yet it's becoming more and more difficult for small businesses to stay afloat. And young people today that want to do the same thing I did, the opportunities are, it's a lot more difficult, a lot more expensive. So I think we just need to take a look at that. We need to balance the well-meaning legislation that we create with the reality of we're killing jobs, and it's hurting working class citizens in this county and beyond.
Thank you, Linda, to Debbie.
Would you welcome a chance to consider a farm workers' bill of rights comparable to those proposed in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties?
That's a good question. I was just made familiar with that attempt to have a farm workers' bill of rights just this morning, so I'm not familiar enough to give you a yes or no answer. But as I do with anything, I have some very dear friends that are in the farm labor contracting business, Hispanic friends that would certainly know more about the pros and cons of something like that. So I'd be glad to answer that question when I'm more familiar with it, but admittedly, I saw it for the first time this morning, and I haven't really had a chance to read it through.
Mm-hmm. Eric.
Well, like my opponent here, I'm not that familiar with that, but having worked on farms myself and helping my grandfather with our apple ranch up in Watsonville, we had a lot of farm workers that came in. So we wanted to provide them with a good salary, with a place to live. I think you have to be fair to everyone that you're working with. You have to pay a fair wage with decent, working conditions and, hours. So I think you just have to be fair to all your employees, whether they're a farm worker or a garment worker. You got to be fair and pay a fair wage and treat them right.
Thank you. Felix, to Eric.
Thank you. This question is similar to one asked previously, but I think it's important that we read it. Mm-hmm. Someone submitted it. How should we handle the fact that high property values are back up, but middle-class people are being priced out?
Mm. It's difficult for a middle-class person to buy a home these days, for sure. They're priced out. Right now, with our average home price of $497,000 in San Luis Obispo County, I think that's what the median price is. You would have to have an income of, I think it's, that would be about 160% of area median income, so about $120,000 to afford the median priced house. Is that a middle class person at $120,000 in the county? I don't think so. I think our middle class people are probably making $60,000 to $100,000. And to, for them to afford anything, it's very difficult. So that's why we need to work on workforce housing so that we can provide possibly smaller homes, more dense, so we can fit more housing in to areas, infill areas in the cities or in appropriate county areas that can take that type of density and have the services available. But it's a matter of supply and demand. So if we have more supply, hopefully prices will drop. But I've heard from a lot of people that we can't build ourselves out of our housing affordability problem. So we're always going to need to have a backstop. Low income and moderate income help, like through people's self-help housing or the housing authority. For those people that are working hard but can't afford a home, they can still rent and maybe get some assistance with that. It's a tough question around here. This is one of the most highest cost of living areas in the country compared to the cost of housing versus the low wages that that people actually get around here. That combination makes this the most unaffordable area in the county. Or in the state, in the nation. It's the most unaffordable area in the country.
Thank you. Debbie.
It is difficult living in such a beautiful place that where so many people with high incomes, it becomes strictly a supply and demand. But there are creative ways, and I know this has been discussed before, but a lot of our, especially our North County and South County, we have houses on big lots that could accommodate a second home, a rental home, those kinds of things. And I think that as we start to look for housing inventory for workforce housing, we need to start exploring those kinds of possibilities to just create more of a rental inventory to begin with. And then again, zone for the different diverse kinds of housing, so that we can afford the best we can in a free market society, housing it for our workforce people. You know, we've known for a long time, I mean, we've all heard stories about the chicken coop in Morro Bay that's on the market for $2 million. I mean, it's location, location, location. So knowing that, again, zoning and trying to create affordable workforce housing, and then I don't know that we're ever going to be able to do much about the affluent folks that really want to come and enjoy what we all are so lucky to enjoy.
Steve, your question for Debbie.
We have within our county a facility, and as soon as I start talking, you're going to know, that has been closed for many years. Nobody knows what to do with it. As a county supervisor or a possible elected county supervisor, what are your suggestions how we best use the old boys home out on Airport Road?
Yeah. That I've heard so many people with so many different suggestions on how to use that property. It's state-owned now, and I guess that the person that's lucky enough to be able to lobby the state to give up that asset or allow someone else to lease and use the asset. But people have tried and over the years, and apparently the state still wants to keep that facility in their inventory for the time being. I think it's just a matter of lobbying and having the right plan, and anything's possible that maybe at some point with the right kind of plan for the property that the state would be willing to relinquish control and let us use it for one of the many things over the years that folks have come up with that property would make a good spot for doing. So anyway, state property, like so many of our state and federal facilities in this area, it's about negotiating with the state.
Thank you, Eric.
Well, the boys' school has been vacant for so long. It's in pretty much disrepair right now, and it would take a lot of money to get it back into shape and into compliance with building regulations and handicap access and everything else. I know that some people have talked about it, using it as a homeless shelter. Maybe. I think if there were people out there that wanted to utilize that building, they would have. And you can't force people to use a building like that. If somebody wants to use it or sees a need or an opportunity, they will take it. I mean, that's what we're all about here in this country. If we see something that's valuable and we can take advantage of it, we do it. I don't see anybody jumping to take over that facility.
Okay, thank you. Mary Elena. Okay, as a director of the Air Pollution Control District, what qualifications will you seek in Larry Allen's successor after he retires as executive director next year?
Could you repeat that again? You asked me if I was the air pollution control director, or
as a director of the air.
As the supervisor, as a director.
What qualifications will you seek
For someone to replace the current,
right?
The current supervisor director of it. Obviously, somebody that has some background in air pollution and things like that, and testing. I happen to know one fellow that actually does the air quality testing for the dunes and a lot of other properties. A very scientific oriented job. Now that's the workers that are out there, but you need a supervisor that can organize his workers to get good people working for him and to follow the law. Right now I know the air pollution is under attack from very many different directions. There was another lawsuit filed against the state and air pollution based on the dunes dust. The people that use the dunes don't think it's a problem. But if you talk to the people in the Pomo that live in the Mesa that are breathing the dust, they're very concerned about it. So we need somebody that's running that, that has an open mind, that's not, doesn't have an agenda, that really can help to put that organization back into a good functioning one that has the support of the population. Right now, half the people don't trust the organization. So we need somebody in there that can reestablish the credibility of it. You know, I think he might be doing a good job, but credibility-wise, a lot of people don't think so. So when he's gone, I want to get somebody in there that can rebuild the credibility of that organization, because it's important.
Debbie.
The Air Pollution Control District, of which I'm a member of that board, plays an important role in ensuring that our county is in compliance with the many state laws that regulate air quality. What I would look for in a successor or anyone that was to lead that agency, that particular agency, would be someone that obviously is familiar with the laws and the air pollution and air quality laws, but also someone that can work collaboratively with the other agencies. Anymore, most projects and most efforts are really need a collaboration of several different agencies, and it should be the job of a leader of an agency like Air Pollution Control District to be able to work collaboratively, solve problems within the county, but that particular agency has really had a difficult time, and the lawsuits and the taxpayer dollars on fighting taxpayer dollars in court has become very expensive. So hopefully we'll get past that and be able to work a little more collaboratively to solve our problems.
Thank you. So, Linda, our next question to Debbie.
Actually, this was directed to Eric, or would you like me to ask both?
Well, yeah, if there's a question directed to a particular person, we'll allow both candidates to respond.
Thank you. I'm not sure if this is... Why were you against the Santa Margarita quarry, or for? I guess I would state it either way. The Santa Margarita quarry. Why were you for or against it?
Whose turn is it?
actually.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought we were projecting that at Eric. When that project came before me to vote on, I voted in support of the project. That quarry is part of a mineral deposit that has been recognized by the state many years ago. It goes from Santa Margarita and it goes north to south of Tascadero. Two mines are actually operating within this mineral deposit that in question here. But we've touched on this today. Affordable housing, maintaining our infrastructure, our road infrastructure, all those things require base and the mineral. This is a high-quality mineral deposit that the state actually has recognized as such. And several boards of supervisors prior to me have also recognized and signed on to various documents recognizing that there's a need to keep that available for the future. And for me, you know, the statistics show that when we have to go two counties away to get the materials that we know we need, it's part of being sustainable, helping with a better air quality, and the pros and cons of having our businesses staying right here locally were important. Santa Margarita, as you know, is a small town that is setting right on the edge of a state highway, and so that was a difficult decision for me to make. Though I do have grandchildren that attend the school, and I safety at the school just wasn't an issue with the crossing guard. Sometimes I feel it's even safer when we have a project enhancing the safety of the school children. That is a state highway that's also used by a lot of tourists going out to Santa Margarita Lake, boat, pulling boats, campers, those kinds of things. So it's a well-used state highway, and I went over. Sorry about that.
Thank you, Debbie. Eric.
could you repeat that one more time? Sorry.
Had to do with the Santa Maria Quarry.
Yeah, I know it's
and what your position is on the Margarita. Sorry, I didn't mean Santa Maria. I mean the Santa Margarita Quarry.
Why were you against the Santa Margarita Quarry?
Well, I'll speak to the quarry rather than whether or not I voted on it. I didn't vote on it. The quarry was analyzed by our planning department. It was a full EIR was done. They found that the aggregate was not necessary. We have plenty of aggregate with the Hanson Quarry and the Rocky Canyon quarries. There were unmitigatable impacts to the community, traffic safety, too many trucks. A lot of issues there that could not be mitigated. It just was not necessary. When I make a decision, I like to weigh the positives and the negatives of a project. If the negatives far outweigh the benefits of that, I have to vote no on it. But I also have to look at the law. It said that the law says that that property had to have a conditional use report on, or a minor use report, one of the two, I don't remember, but therefore, it has to have environmental review. It has to have full mitigation of most of those, be able to mitigate the negative impacts. It didn't meet the qualifications to be approved. It was denied by the Planning Commission. The Planning Department, with all their expert staff on it, recommended denial. The town really was not supportive. And I just have to think, the town is really growing up downtown. I look at the new Ancient Peaks Winery, and I would hate to be sitting out there on the table having a nice glass of Chardonnay and the trucks just roaring by one after another, the dust, the noise. It just isn't right for the community of Santa Margarita.
Thank you. Felix, your question to Eric.
Okay, how much weight do you place on county staff opinions when making a decision?
I have to place a lot of weight on there. They're the experts. I don't know everything, and I can't know everything. But I have to look at staff's recommendations. Did they do a thorough analysis of a problem or an application? I need to look at that to make sure they did a good, thorough analysis. But I have to rely on staff. They're the experts on many things. And if they're not doing the job, we need somebody else in there. But, you know, you have to rely on staff at some point. You have to. If you're a good leader, you surround yourself with good people. So, you know, I would rely quite a bit on staff. Although I would have to analyze everything they do because, you know, they're not always going to be perfect. But for the most part, I think you have to rely on them.
Thank you. Debbie.
I think I mentioned before that often our ordinances and our policies are written and passed with a little bit of wiggle room for particular interpretation. So, and, you know, we have a staff at the county planning department that is doing their job. I mean, but it's really up to the, I think it's really up to the electeds who are sent there by the people. It's an important time when projects come before the Board of Supervisors to take a look and be, you're the last word, and you really do need to represent the people that sent you there. Sometimes that creates conflict with the staff or particular direction the staff would like to see things go. But as representatives of the people, I think it's really important to ask questions, do a little more research, and discuss and debate projects as they come along.
Thank you. So we are at about the halfway point with the questions, so I want to give them a little brain rest for a second and let you know about a couple of our upcoming events. So the next event for Latino Outreach Council will be Fiesta Latina, which is our major fundraiser on May 1 at the Edwards Barn in Nipomo. This is a wonderful, fun event with mariachis, gourmet Mexican food, Latin dancing, if you like to Latin dancing, and an auction. So we do have reservations available if you'd like to reserve a couple spots or for yourself and your friends to join us May 1 for Fiesta Latina. Our next candidates forum will be on May 11, and that will be for District 3 candidates forum. It will be at the County Board of Supervisors chambers at 6 p.m., and the next educational forum presented by Latino Outreach Council will be on June 22nd, probably at the Board of Supervisors hearing room again. And our topic will be very timely. We will be discussing immigration, and we will be specifically discussing agricultural workforce housing. There's been a lot in the news lately. I think people are now becoming aware of the H-2A federal program that allows farmers to hire non-resident farm workers. Part of the requirement for that program is that they provide housing. And it is a big issue both in Santa Barbara County and in San Luis Obispo County as to how farm worker housing should be addressed. We intend to invite people from both counties to address this because there is a crossover in both counties. And we hope to be part of the solution for that and at least educate people about what these programs are about, what the law allows for farm worker housing, and maybe come up with some solutions about how this should be addressed. So that's going to be on June 22nd, and we'll be sending out some press releases on that. Okay, we have received a lot more questions, and they've all been fantastic. So we're going to press forward with Steve, and your next question goes to Debbie.
The North County doesn't have many opportunities for adolescent activities outside of athletics. What solutions might you suggest to involve our youth?
That's interesting. I think since my kids grew up in the North County and athletics was a big part of their life, but there have been other opportunities. For example, the junior high school has a performing arts center now, and then the Tascadero Unified School District offers a fine arts academy. We have several opportunities for music and dance, instruction, private studios throughout the North County. And so I think the arts are becoming more represented for children to have those kinds of activities and experiences. And, you know, for me, it's always been important that we continue to ensure that those athletic opportunities are available to kids, both boys and girls, and that we have adequate sports fields so that you know that we can hold organized sports activities, practices, and those kinds of things with no shortage. So we can always use more, but I see Boys and Girls Club thriving. I see lots of volunteers working with the Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, and all the various clubs and organizations that we have out there. Thank you. Eric.
Yes, sports is a very important component of our youth in the North County. My daughters took great advantage of sports. And I think the question was, what other activities could we get them involved with? You know, community involvement is very important. I think there's a lot of opportunities where we can involve our youth in the community. In San Luis Obispo, they have a community responsibility component in the high school where they have to do something in the community besides, you know, just living there. They have to help out somewhere. They can help with seniors. They can help at the homeless center. We got to make more opportunities available for kids to get involved in the community by requiring them to, basically. It could be part of the school program. Cal Poly does require their students to get involved in the community. They have to have community points. They have to get involved, and that's you know, part of their responsibility. And I think farms. We have a lot of farms in the area, small farms. I love to have youth at my farm. We have a program called WOOF, the Willing Workers on Organic Farms. And we bring in kids from all over the United States, all over the world, to come and stay at our farm for a couple of days, for a month. We've had people there for as long as 14 months, learning how to farm, getting involved. I mean, we can get kids more involved in the agriculture that way, besides just FFA and all that. But there's ways to get kids that aren't usually involved in agriculture involved in it. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities out there, and we need to take advantage of all that we can, besides athletics, which I love.
Right. Thank you. Mary Elena.
All right. Do you support the Phillips 66 rail project? Why or why not? Mm-hmm. And who benefits from this proposal?
Well, Phillips 66 will be the prime beneficiary of that proposal. They might have a few new jobs there, four or five new jobs for workers there. Unfortunately, the negative consequences that could happen from an accident would be catastrophic. It's not just a parking lot for oil tank cars to park and be unloaded. There's unmitigated environmental things there on the site as well. But it's interesting to note that almost every city along the route from California was at these hearings. They were very concerned about safety. I'm concerned about safety. You know, in the 1970s, we had a derailment on the Cuesta grade. If you look at the grade, you can see where the land was reconfigured after those train cars rolled down. Can you imagine if it wasn't a freight train car, if it was a tank car? We've heard from many fire people around the state that they don't believe we have the capacity to deal with a fire situation like that. So I would have to be opposed to it, knowing what I know now. Unless new information comes forward that shows that it's safe, I can't see how I could support it.
Debbie.
Yeah, this one's a little tricky for me. It's we all know that the Phillips 66 project is at the Planning Commission now and could very well end up on appeal in front of the Board of Supervisors. But I do want to say that should that happen, and that, you know, if we see that project on appeal, the project itself is a what I like to call a parking place for rail cars, but at an existing refinery in the southern part of this county. It does include transporting oil by rail. The oil by rail will be the trains will be going through our county no matter what. So if the project is it comes before us, I will be focused on safety in making any kind of decision. But it is I would certainly, with or without this project, be supportive of enhancing our first response and those kinds of things, as we know that these trains are moving through the county with or without any project here locally.
Linda, for Debbie.
Okay, Debbie, do you support the development, development and annexation of Eagle Ranch into the city of Atascadero?
That would be a choice that the city's going to make, and I would be supportive of the city should they make that choice. The development that the proposed future development of Eagle Ranch is one that was the lots were subdivided many, many years ago during the colony days, and have been sitting undeveloped until the present day. So whether the owners of those properties choose to develop those lots outside the city limits or inside the city limits, I think, that's for future discussion. But I would absolutely support the city if they are ready. That's in the sphere of influence, and that was part of the long-range plan to someday absorb those lots into the city limits. So city's call, and I would be supportive.
Eric.
Well, Eagle Ranch, like was alluded to, was created about 400 lots were created by E.G. Lewis in 1913, and those lots can be developed. They're existing lots, and they have a water right to those rights, to the water right to them. E.G. Lewis took away your individual water rights and gave them to the Mutual Water Company. So anybody that owns a lot in Atascadero has a right to water. So water is not an issue. According to John Neal at the water company, they have plenty of water to handle it. So that's not the issue. The issue is more that they want to do more than the 400 lots. They want to do 700 lots. They want to do some commercial property over there as well. So that really needs to be looked at. If we were talking about the 400 lots in the original consideration, we wouldn't have much to say about that. I think that a new project would be better. I mean, it would be able to make it more concise. It could bring instead of having 5 and 10 acre lots all over the mountains, you could have the development more concentrated and not have as much disturbance to the environment. So that would be good. But we have to look at exactly what they want to do with it. It's going to be studied by the city and the county. If it is annexed to the city, then the property taxes have to be discussed as well, the split of the property taxes. And right now, I know the city is not happy with the proposal from the county. And that begs further discussion that we need a little better relationship between the county and the city when we're doing these things so that we can have a proper distribution of property taxes if it is annexed.
Thank you. Next question for Eric.
Okay. Do you think the North County needs more public open space for recreation?
More public space for open. I think we have quite a bit of recreational space around. I enjoy Santa Margarita Lake and all the trails around it. We have the Salinas River and a lot of areas. But I would support the efforts of the Land Conservancy to acquire open space that could be used for recreation. We have the Los Padres Forest, which is a big area in the North County. I don't know how much more public recreation space we need. It's always good to have parks. I think we're okay right now, but if somebody has some other ideas, I'd be happy to look.
Debbie.
I think it is one of the special things about our county. Often when I talk about development with people and they seem nervous, it's a shame to pave over such a beautiful county. And I reassure them often by saying, somewhere around 75% of our county landmass is unbuildable. It's either public lands or it's in what I call mini conservation easements, but Williamson Act agricultural open space. In the last decade, we've put 300,000 acres into public land with the National Monument, with the development of the National Monument, and then some fish and game land to accompany that. So a big part of the eastern part of our county is federal land now. When you combine that with the Los Padres National Forest and then the many conservation easements that have been procured to create open space, we're doing very well in that category. What I hope to see, and I know that the county's working on this, is more a lot of the parks or trails or recreational open space that is closer into town, more sports fields, more open space that are accessible on a daily basis for our youth. We discussed that, other activities and outdoor activities for families.
Thank you. Steve or Debbie?
How can we best meet the needs of transportation for the elderly, the disabled, and the youth who don't drive? How can we improve our county transportation?
Well, again, we have another expert in the audience. I see Eric sitting back there, and he is one that actually utilizes our public transportation more than anyone else I know. But we actually, for our county, and we are a quasi-rural county, we are constantly improving on our public transportation system. And there are routes where the ridership the numbers are a little higher than others, but this county operates a lot of routes with the public transportation system that are they're operating them to provide the service more than they are to achieve the numbers of ridership. We have several programs throughout the county that provide customized trips for seniors, van pools, and things like that for veterans, and it's improving all the time. So that is one area that I feel comfortable. We're doing a good job, and we're always trying to improve.
Mm-hmm. Eric.
Well, currently, I believe our public transportation for seniors consists of a ride-on and public transportation, buses, taxis, things like that. But I think we have an opportunity coming up with Slow Cogs, looking at additional monies for transportation. Some of that monies would be used to improve opportunities for senior housing or senior transportation and also public transportation in general. So that opportunity is coming up pretty soon. Slow Cog is looking it over, additional funding. That's going to be up to the people to vote on, hopefully.
Okay, Mary Elena, next question for Eric.
Well, Eric, that was the next question, the Slow Cog. So they're talking about the San Luis Obispo Council of Government will soon be proposing a half-cent sales tax increase to fund the county road improvements. Do you support this and why?
At the present time, looking at the proposal, I think it's worthy of a consideration. It will allow us to get additional monies from Caltrans. What the state would like us to do is show our commitment to transportation by passing a 0.5% sales tax override. So with that, we would earn approximately $25 million a year in additional taxes that would have to go to transportation in the county. But with that, we would be eligible for matching funds from Caltrans. It could be, some people say, as high as three times as much as what we raise here. I mean, it's a good idea. I would support it, but however, it's going to go to the people to vote. So like most things to deal with taxation, it's going to be up to the people. If they feel it's that necessary, that they pay that 0.5% sales tax, they'll vote on it. Another thing to consider, though, is that half of that money that comes in is going to be from tourists paying sales tax. It's not all going to be people in the county. So half of that money is going to come from our visitors that are also using our roads, and they will pay their fair share then too. So it's a great idea, but it's up to the people to vote on.
Debbie.
Thank you. We haven't seen the specific details of where the money would be going. Generally speaking, I would not personally be in favor of putting a tax before the people in a year like this, where our county alone has $20 million in revenues over last year's budget. So the county has money that they could prioritize towards transportation, and the state, in the same kind of ratio, the state has experienced extra revenues than what they anticipated when they created their budget. That's not a year to put your hand out, or a time to put your hand out and ask the taxpayers to continue to dig into their pocket with any kind of tax. I know people say, Debbie, it's just a half a cent. The cities, all of our cities have passed measures recently, all seven cities, to put money specifically for their roads, their city roads. The county, in the last 2 years, has put several million dollars, added several million dollars to the budget for maintaining county roads. The county roads and the local roads are not the problem here. It's the state roads. And the state has once again hijacked the truck weight fees to the tune of $1 billion, and they're using it for other things. At some point, I feel like I represent the taxpayers, and I wouldn't be doing a good job of that if I just said, oh, sure, you know, don't ask for the state to step up to the plate and be responsible for its own roads. Let's take care of that, too. We're going to need to get the state's attention to be, especially when it comes to maintaining and improvements on state highways. So until I see more specific plans, I am really, this is not the right year to be asking the taxpayers to reach into their pocket again.
Okay, next question is for Debbie.
Okay. Do you agree or disagree with a quiet title lawsuit, and why or why not?
As a rural landowner, you know, I tell people, if you're a rural landowner in this county, you're in a minority in the political arena within the county. And just by living in this county, you're in a political minority in Sacramento. When you're in a political minority and you can be outvoted on things that are basic property rights, then you need to depend on what our system in this country gives us, and that's your individual rights, your individual freedom. The people that have asked for their asked to quiet their title are simply going to court saying, you know, the Constitution allows us to live on the property here and be able to use the water underneath us for reasonable and beneficial use, not for selling, not for running off of our property, but for reasonable and beneficial use. And we want to confirm that through this court system. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Good for them. They, as minorities, they may not have that opportunity if those decisions are made in the political arena. But certainly the California Constitution gives them that right, and they would like to affirm it. Eric.
Well, I suppose they have the right to sue. Everybody has a right to sue. I don't particularly like lawsuits myself. I think it's better to try to work together to solve problems. The entire area up there was working together for quite a while. Then that lawsuit was filed, and it created quite a problem. We had a blue ribbon committee studying the water issues up in the Paso Robles area, and then the lawsuit came down, and it scared a lot of people. I mean, sure, the people have a right to use the water that's under their ground for beneficial use, but they don't have a right to just pump indiscriminately. I mean, if you're having a water problem, what did the state do here to you? As citizens of Atascadero or the county, if you had a water meter, Governor Brown asked you to cut back 25%. And you did. If there's a problem in the vineyards and the water basin up there, and we had an agency that asked the vineyards to cut back 25%, don't they have that responsibility too for the benefit of the entire population? It's not just their water. They don't own the water. The water is owned by the public. They have a right to beneficial use of that water, but it's not their water. So we have to distinguish between that. And they need to use the water for their crops. That's great. But they have a right to beneficial use of the water. They don't own it. And
I think it's a waste of time on this lawsuit, but you have a right to sue, I guess, anytime you want. That's it.
Felix, your question for Eric.
Thank you. What should be done to encourage the Latino community to participate in the civic affairs of this county?
Well, it's like I think I answered an earlier question, similar. We have to do outreach. We have to reach the people that are least likely to respond, that are least likely to apply. To get them involved in government, we need the Latino Outreach Council to reach out to the people in the community and say, join us, get involved. We need you to get involved. It's very important. But it's more difficult for some people to reach out. But if you have a relationship with people through the Latino Outreach Council, there's a lot of people you can reach. There are other groups as well. So when we were doing outreach at Peoples, we looked for almost every single different community organization that related in some way or another with the Latino population. If it was TV stations, radio, newspapers, civic groups, you have to hit them all. So you can hit the people and notify the people that are least likely to get involved. There's always that 10 or 20% that get involved. There's 80% that don't. It's the old rule. 20% do all the work, and 80% just sit back. So you have to get those people involved by reaching out, and that's the way to do it.
Thank you. Debbie.
Right in front of me, that we've got several people that are doing an excellent job of doing just that and reaching out to the Latino community with LULAC, the Latino Outreach Council, and the Hispanic Business Community. So the activities, I know I personally am involved with the Latino Outreach Council and appreciate, and I'm sure the Latino communities appreciate the different events that are hosted by the Latino Outreach Council. And even this forum tonight helps just inform the Latino community and all of the communities about what their choices are when it comes to elected officials.
Thank you. Steve.
I think a question that goes along with one of the answers just a minute ago. Do you believe that private wells will need to be metered to achieve groundwater basin stabilization? Why or why not?
Okay, and I'm really glad to be able to follow up on that, because what we saw in, at least in my district of the Paso Robles Basin, the folks that were trying to quiet their title to ensure that they wouldn't be priced off their property or metered away, the use of their water metered away, those are the folks, the families, the small, the de minimis, what the state calls de minimis users, not the large irrigators that have used quieting their title as a tool just to ensure that they'll be able to continue the use of their property. The SGMA law that we will be complying with, and really our county is very well prepared in the Paso Robles Basin of the five to become SGMA compliant. The law does give the Groundwater Sustainability Agency the opportunity to meter and monitor what combination that will be. It actually spells out, though, that anyone using under 2 acre-feet a year, which would be most of your households and small rural properties, are de minimis and will be exempt from the SGMA law. So it looks like it is time to take a look at the heavy usage that's coming in with large agribusiness. But again, the folks that are trying to quiet their title are kind of just caught up in a situation where they need some protection for their own property rights.
Eric.
To get really any kind of handle on the water use, we're going to have to do metering at some point. I've been in other states looking at what they do. In Utah, they don't necessarily meter a well. They give you so many sprinklers to use at a time. They monitor the amount of water by, you know, how many sprinklers you have out in your field. If you're part of an irrigation district, that's how they meter it. It doesn't have to be done by meters, but we're going to have to get control on, well, I shouldn't say control, but some kind of way to monitor the use of water so that if we continue to have this drought and we have to sort of ration water out so that everybody gets a fair share, then how are we going to monitor that in any other way? It's the only way we really can. And this, you know, basically, hopefully we can control our own water district, and then we can decide what to do. But if the state comes in and we don't get the job done, and they're probably going to want to meter it because they're only going to look at demand. You know, how much are people using? They can't provide any supply. So that's what they're going to do, is control demand. So hopefully we'll control the district ourselves up there and throughout the county. But I think meters eventually are going to have to be used.
Okay. Marilena, for Eric.
Okay. I think this is a question that we said earlier that our youth needs to get involved. So this is a question, I think, from the youth crowd. Can the county help fund sports activities for all kids, even homeschool and private school?
Well, can they? Okay. Yeah, I think that all kids, all children should have a right to activities if they can't afford them. I would agree. The county, if we have monies available through social services, I know that at People's Self-Help Housing, we had a lot of low-income people that we were able to get grants from different agencies to help with youth sports, especially summertime. Summer, kids aren't in school and they don't have a lot to do, so we always tried to have some activities for them in the summer, and we would look for grants and other means to raise money to help the kids out in those times. So if we can do something, yeah, if we have the funding.
Thank you. Debbie.
Yes, the county doesn't really play a role in organized youth sports directly, but indirectly, each supervisor in the county has a community project fund, and they can choose to donate grant money to youth sports activities if that is something that they see fit to do in their particular district. Also, the county does support in different ways the YMCA and other organizations that provide activities for organized youth sports all along the way. And I know in my district and here in Atascadero, the school districts do what they can to support the youth soccer leagues, the little leagues, and so forth and so on. So it's kind of a collaborative effort within the communities to ensure that there are fields and the financial wherewithal to keep these youth sports going.
Thank you. Linda, for Debbie.
Okay, Debbie. How would you create more jobs in Slo County? What policies would you get rid of or put in place for those efforts?
We touched on that a little bit before, but the backbone of the economy, the business economy in this county has been small business. We've kind of morphed into, we depended a lot, our economy depended on agriculture, and now agriculture is kind of morphed into ag tourism and some just general tourism. But again, it's supporting the small businesses and understanding that every single fee and every single requirement and regulation that requires you to stay up all night filling out paperwork of a different kind, it makes it more difficult for these entrepreneurs to be able to do business in the county. So I think, again, just being mindful and try to slow down that regulatory climate that has really been hurting small business in this county and throughout the state.
Thank you, Eric.
Yeah, we have a lot of opportunities to help in the county right now. We have the Economic Vitality Corporation. We have the Cal Poly Incubator Programs that are creating new small jobs. Those are all very important. We need the county is funding the incubator program, and they are cooperating with the EBC to attract more businesses to the area, and that would create more jobs. But locally, I've been meeting with our trades unions. The plumbers, the pipe fitters, the electricians, the construction trade guys, who have tremendous training programs in their facilities. Excellent programs where they can train an apprentice to become a journeyman and have a head of household job. But they need our support. The unions asked me, could you support project labor agreements? Those are a kind of a neat opportunity to support local workers with our county jobs. Right now, our Public Works Department does not give a preference to local contractors on jobs that we, you know, we just had a $150 million project out in Los Osos. But if we had a PLL agreement, those people, those are already prevailing wage jobs out there. So it's not going to increase the cost of labor, but it's going to give the local labor unions a chance to put their workers to work and also support their training programs that they have in their facilities. So I think it's a good way that we can partner with them and create more head of household jobs.
Thank you. So we have time for one last question before we go to your closing remarks. So who's up next? Felix. Yes.
Thank you. Since both of you claim to be farmers, what do you feel is the top issue facing agriculture besides water?
Mm-hmm. Is that?
Yes.
Go ahead.
And that question actually goes to Eric first.
Yeah. My turn. Well, you know, one of the major issues facing farmers right now is dealing with the Regional Water Quality Control Board. I have to deal with them as far as my use of fertilizers, water, everything on my crops. So there's a lot of cooperation you have to do with Regional Water to make sure that you're not using too much nitrogen. There's a lot of regulations out there. In fact, Regional Water can make me monitor my well right now. You know, that's part of their job, to make sure I don't have extra nitrates in there. There's a lot of issues facing agriculture right now. I'm a pretty small farmer right now. I used to have a bigger farm in Los Osos, where we had 125 families getting a box of veggies every week, and I did 6 farmers markets. And right there in the middle of that business, we started to have the farm, the safety, forget what you call it, but produce safety regulations came up. And so now we have to bring inspectors out to the bigger farms to inspect, to make sure that you don't have animals running around in your crops and things like that. So that's one of the reasons why I felt that we needed to get away from the big commercial farm. And just so right now we have more of a gentleman's farm. I'm retired anyway, out in the Pozo area, not in Pozo itself, but in the area. I love farming. I love getting out in the dirt. I was there this morning. It was kind of a relaxing moment for me to be planting or creating some rows to plant some lettuce the next day I get a chance. But farmers have a lot to deal with. The Food Safety Modernization Act or something like that, safety, product safety is very important right now. I have to have insurance to cover myself, even at a farmer's market. So there's a lot of regulations that we have to deal with.
Thank you, Debbie.
Yes, and coming from two different kind of farm ranch experiences, I'm part of a generational family farm where it's just the size that our family kind of operates. But we, too, struggle with additional regulation that takes is so time-consuming that it's difficult for a family business to manage the time to do all of it. Costs are going up. Regulation is going up. We answer to a lot of agencies, and it really has become more challenging. The agribusiness, the larger farms, working for Senator Blakeslee in both the Assembly and the Senate, I was kind of the staff person that was responsible for working with state legislation that had to do with our agricultural industries. And I know that our larger farms in the area are dealing with water issues, a lot of regulation coming down the pike, and then labor issues is a huge problem right now. The unavailability of sufficient labor to be able to pick the crops. So again, farmers are facing a lot of challenges. They always have, and I'm pretty sure they always will. And I didn't even mention commodity prices that are out of our control. So you just never know. I always tease my husband, you know what? Seems like it would have been easier just to go to Las Vegas once a year and roll dice than be in this business. But it's a lifestyle and also a very important industry in this county.
Well, thank you very much, and I want to thank our esteemed panel for posing those questions so eloquently, and thank you to the audience for some really insightful questions. And at this time, I'm going to ask each of the candidates to give basically a three-minute close and tell the voters why you want to be supervisor and why they should vote for you. We will start with Debbie Arnold and finish with Eric Michelson.
Okay, I'd like to in this evening by thanking the panel as well. And again, thanking all of you for coming out. It has been truly an honor to represent the 5th District and this county at the Board of Supervisors, on the Board of Supervisors. And I really have been thankful for my experience working at the state level. I think that the experience and process at all levels of government has really helped me be a more effective representative for all of you. When I ran for supervisor, I was very concerned about the regulatory land use policies that were coming out of the county, and I went running on the platform that I would hold government accountable. I would promote a healthy local economy that hopefully would create more jobs and opportunities for our young people. I would protect our open space and our rural way of life, and then, of course, make fire protection and public safety a priority. And with every single vote, I have held true to those promises I made to all of you. I think that has, in part, earned me the support of our law enforcement folks, our district attorney, Dan Dow. I'm supported by the Deputy Sheriff's Association here in the county, and our sheriff himself has donated to my campaign in a show of support. We have another supervisor here in the audience that's become a good friend and has also endorsed me. So many community leaders, our elected assessor, Tom Bordenaro, and my former boss, former Senator Sam Blakesley. So, and that's just the tip of the iceberg. I'm so pleased to have school board members. We have city council folks in the Councilwoman Fonzie's in the audience here that have become very good friends. I feel colleagues and have supported my bid to re-election. So it is my hope that I will be re-elected in June so that I can continue to work on these issues we've discussed tonight and help make our county a better place for providing opportunities for families, working families, and all of us that live here in the county.
Thank you. Eric.
Thank you again to the Latino Outreach Council for putting this on, and the great panels, good questions out there. I want to thank the League of Women Voters for sponsoring our discussions tonight. And this isn't really about me or my opponent. You know, this election is really about you. It's about you and protecting and improving your quality of life. That's what it's about. Politics, nationally and locally, is kind of broken. Toxic, one guy told me. Our supervisors too often argue based on ideology rather than the facts or the needs of our community and our residents. I pledge to bring civility and cooperation back to the Board of Supervisors, because without collaboration, it's difficult to do the job of the people. Together, we can face our challenges successfully, and you can really help by voting for me, Eric Michelson, and providing whatever support you can. My campaign is a grassroots campaign with hundreds of people helping out. Please visit my website, ericforsupervisor.com, and you can see the hundreds of people that have endorsed me, including community leaders, politicians, and people all over the county. You can see it, my supporters, right on my website. And it would be a real honor to serve you as your supervisor, and I really look forward to it. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, once again, thank you for both of you for being willing to step up to the plate. I want to thank the support of the Hispanic Business Association, the Chamber of Commerce, Latino Outreach, LULAC, and especially the League of Women Voters for making this campaign candidates forum possible. And thank you, everybody, for coming.